Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
Hey guys, my name is Ash Martis. I am the CEO and co-founder of StartupFuel.com. I am proudly to say that I'm a valuation expert for startup companies. I studied that in my education, my career. But I, more than anything, I'm an advocate for democratization of capital access for all entrepreneurs around the world. I'm trying to create a fair and equal access ecosystem for anybody trying to achieve their dreams through innovation and entrepreneurship.
Well, super exciting, Ash, and thanks so much for making time to join us on the Ivy Podcast. Your self-introduction is pretty powerful in a sense. Makes me a little bit jealous in a way that I wish I had met you when I was during the process of scaling, starting, fundraising my startups, you know, 6-8 years ago, which is, you know, I'm excited to have this conversation with you today. So tell us a little bit more about Startup Fuel. How did you come about actually getting to building this mission, and where are you going next with that?
Yeah, for sure. So I'll tell you, start off with my like background, how I came into this ecosystem. So yeah. I went to Schuller School of Business, one of the top business schools in North America. And I actually planning to study accounting. That was my entire goal. In my first year, a buddy of mine and his older brother had started a textbook rental company. And I was following it and was kind of helping advise from a financial standpoint. That company was then sold almost a year later. And I just fell in love with the world of startups and entrepreneurship and how fast people can grow and scale businesses. And so I decided, instead of specializing in accounting, I stepped away from accounting and focused on venture capital, finance, and entrepreneurship. Became an expert in valuations, learned about how startups are growing. And at that time, it was 2010. So the startup boom just began maybe, you know, in Silicon Valley about 10, 15 years ago, and is spreading around the world. So here in Canada, it was quite interesting. There were some brand new companies popping up off the ground, and the movement wasn't as quite robust as it is today. But I really wanted to become an expert, and I kind of fell in love with this space. So what I did, what actually started for me this business, was I looked at the way valuations were being done. I worked in TD Bank in a mutual fund division, and I was looking at valuations of startups going public. The LinkedIns of the world and Airbnbs. And at that time, I noticed a massive disparity in what we learned in school for how to value early stage companies to like later stage companies. So I decided that startups are a brand new type of model, and you can't apply the same valuation framework that you did in the past. And so I set out on a mission to create a new one, a brand new model that accounts for something that is very unique about startups, which means the R&D, that the time it takes to commercialize a research or product. In some cases, happens right away, like e-commerce companies, we can start a website today and start making money by the evening. Like that's how quick it is. Other companies, deep tech, may take 3 to 5, 10 years before the data and the research is enough to start commercializing it. How are we valuing these two companies the same way when they have completely different spectrums? And that's what it got me to think, okay, we need a new model to do this. So I did. I built a brand new model. I called it the Pangea model. It used every model around the world with a weighted average system based on different industries. And it was working. It was a really great measure of valuations. And I went to LA, Los Angeles, because my buddy was down there. Went to some networking events, stayed there in LA for a little bit, and ended up meeting an angel investment group at a hackathon called Angel Hack. And they were like, we'd love to invest outside of California. It's getting very saturated for us. We want to go to the other parts of the country, New York, Rhode Island, even in Canada, the Toronto-Waterloo corridor. So they're like, you know, we don't know anybody over there. Do you, you know, with your history? And at that time I was 3 startups in. They're like, could you help us find good companies? And I said, sure, of course. I recommended a few companies. They invested in one of them. And that's how everything began. And I was like, wow, I could be a scout. An external scout for investors to help them find companies, and then vice versa for companies. That's how I began this entire world. From that time, the next 9 years until just before the pandemic, I attended 775 networking events. I did almost two religiously per week. I did it all over the world in almost 30 different cities, starting in Toronto, Montreal, Ottawa, went down to New York, LA, Miami, Chicago, Milwaukee, and then I went to Europe. I went to London, Paris, Reykjavik in Iceland, Italy. Then I went to Asia. So I was in Dubai, Kuwait, Bangalore in India. And I started studying the world of startups in going to all these networking events. And I realized that it's such a new industry that has come up in the last 25 years. There's a lot of inefficiencies with the way the industry is run. And if we took our connection network, and at that time with 775 networking events, I had amassed around 40,000 people network, 40,000 people from around the world, all in startups, innovation, corporations. And I decided that I was a big super connector. People were asking me all over the place, hey, Ash, could you introduce me to a marketer? Could you introduce me to an investor? And I was making these email intros. And a lot of times it was working. All these people came back to me and said, hey, thanks. This was a great connection. Where'd you find them? And I realized that I couldn't only be a node to connect people. So I said, why don't I take my network, turn it into a new startup platform called Startup Fuel, which is very similar to LinkedIn, but instead of connecting people looking for careers, why don't we create an entrepreneurial social network around the world? And that's how Startup Fuel began.
Wow, what a story, and quite impressive numbers in terms of the networking events that you had attended, the number of connections you were able to accumulate. So definitely congrats on all the success so far. And, you know, the super connector, I think that's pretty unique value proposition, especially in the startup world. In fact, it's one of the ingredients for my thesis, how I angel invest into tech startups myself. And, you know, I don't have the fund to be able to write small checks initially to test how the entrepreneurs basically operate. But what I do is I make that small introduction for that particular founder and basically see how they operate with that particular introduction. How's the follow up? How's the follow through? And just basically that gives me some of the small indicators from that perspective, how they operate. So there's just kind of a little bit of a inside look into this. So that's super exciting. When it comes to where you're going with Startup Fuel, there's definitely quite a few organizations that do have very similar missions in the sense helping entrepreneurs, which is very exciting. I wish there were a lot more of those back in the day when we were growing startups ourselves. But what are the different opportunities and trends that you see in this particular industry? I'm sure you research that quite a bit. You read a lot. You obviously network pretty extensively. Where do you see this, industry going just in general from entrepreneurship perspective? Obviously, the world has gone, completely virtual. What are some of the trends you're spotting and observing?
Yeah, it used to be that IT and technology used to be its own industry. That's what it used to be in the past. Now it's a part of every industry. It's disrupting every single sector out there that we can't call it an industry anymore. It's almost like a super industry sitting on top of every single vertical. Where I see startups kind of moving towards is the empowerment of everyday people to step away from corporations and try to innovate beyond the slow moving chasm that is large corporations. And I think we have so many problems in humanity that need to be solved. And every day new companies are coming out to solve it. We already know in our world, almost a ton of things we do on our daily basis have all been influenced because of startups. Our Netflix subscriptions, our Spotify subscriptions, our Google searches, our like the way we do Zoom, the call itself, the Zoom call itself is a startup company, our podcast system. A lot of our life has come out of this startup movement, and it's still just beginning. Like we, in North America, in a more Western world, the technology has been adopted a lot quicker because of how the internet was set up. But now there's so many regions around the world, especially in Africa, in Bangalore, in India, in parts of Romania, that are still just starting their startup ecosystem journeys. So I really believe it's an empowerment of the self, of individuals, and it's bringing more freedom than before. The ability for entrepreneurs to be able to start businesses and dictate their own schedules, own time, work at their own pace, not be constricted to a 9-to-5 barrier. If you're a single mom or you're taking care of kids, you have the options and the flexibility of working when and how you want for the return you want. That is something that we should have adopted as a society many, many years ago. Unfortunately, capitalism was built up in such a way that these large conglomerates were taking, you know, took a lot of capital and brought in a lot of people underneath as employees. And I honestly feel as somebody who's worked in TD Bank, one of the largest banks in the world, in Procter & Gamble, one of the top CPG companies in the world, and in IBM, one of the largest consulting firms, I honestly think corporation per se is starting to move away from these concentrated, closed off entities to more open, where we're working with a lot with smaller groups who are specialized in what they do, right? So that's the area. There's still so much to be done. And something that we are focusing on as well is the democratization of capital. Today, the access to resources is not widely spread. It's not distributed evenly for everybody. There are certain groups who have intrinsic kind of, you know, unfair advantages of accessing things and becoming successful, whereas a lot of other people don't. And we don't believe that's fair. And I something that I'm focusing with Startup Fuel is creating, removing barriers so that everybody from any place in the world, they can come in and create businesses. One investor that I met in Silicon Valley, you know, who wrote a great book, and I'll definitely reference a little bit later, looked at what we're doing and called us the virtual Silicon Valley, where we're taking the entire movement of how concentrated Silicon Valley was, and we're bringing it to the cloud, allowing people, even in smaller cities that don't have access to move to a San Francisco and LA, will still have the opportunity to build large successful ventures just by accessing the internet.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, absolutely. I think those are definitely very interesting trends in this space. And so to shift gears a little bit with your specialization when it comes to valuation of the startups, it's such a, you know, it's also, you know, I view that as a combination of art and the science, because at the end of the day, there's so many different components that go into each individual case on how you evaluate. I've been there myself when I was doing the fundraising for my startups. And, you know, on the other side, as an investor, there's always that component of how do you properly evaluate your startup, especially those that are extremely early stage, pre-seed, when you're just, you know, at ideation. And perhaps you don't have a lot of data, not only from your performance perspective, but from the industry and perhaps the competition. What are some of the common mistakes that you're seeing when entrepreneurs trying to evaluate their early stage startups? What are some of the pitfalls that, you know, if you were to categorize when it comes to the very early stage valuation, you know, metrics, what do you recommend for entrepreneurs during their very early stages when it comes to valuating?
I think everybody needs to introduce sensitivity scenarios into their evaluations. Have, you know, I understand that not all entrepreneurs are financially savvy, so they don't understand, like, you know, how to build maybe great financial models or things like that. And it shouldn't. And there's a lot of tools have come out now to help online people to do this. But having scenarios of, like, you know, A, B, and C. This is A is great. If everything works out as our plan, this is what we plan to do. B is what happens on average? What has other people done? And then C is what happens if things don't go well? How do we account for that? And using those three examples to understand, okay, where do we rank currently with our team? How well are we positioned to do that will help a lot. It's at the early stage, it is more of an art than a science. And what I'm trying to do is I've been downloading data on deals for the last 30 years, 18,000 deals, and analyzing 400 characteristics of every single deal that has been done to create predictive analytics for how different sectors and different countries and regions are predicting traction and early stage teams to be able to achieve total addressable market into the future. And it's a lot of work and it's a lot of time to consume it. But what I'm starting to notice is that evaluations are very different in different regions of the world. Very different. You cannot compare companies in one region. This is what entrepreneurs make a big mistake doing. Oh, I saw, you know, Twitter be able to raise this number, so I should be able to do that. Now, that represents two different differentiations. Number one is time. It's a different era when you're starting this company, when Twitter started it. You can't use the same model that company did. You have to do something more similar to what you are today. And secondly, it also location-wise, in a different region, like a Silicon Valley, because of the concentration of companies, valuations are a lot higher. And also the region also has a very high, cost of living. which accounts for that valuation. You can't use that same number all over the world.
So GDP alone is a big differentiator.
GDP alone is a huge difference. Exactly. So when the two things that I see entrepreneurs make a lot of mistakes is saying comparables. So when they're looking at comparative to other companies in their space, they're not doing a good job of taking into account industry, location, as well time period of when those investments were made. When you combine those two and you start doing sensitivity as well, I think you start understanding a little bit more of how investors think. And, you know, baking in the main important point, you know, when you're raising capital, at the end of the day, you're either going after angel investors, VC funds, your own friends and family, or, you know, debt, right? Depending on the method of how you're raising, there's a purpose that the other side has. Learning as much as you can about the other side, their motivations, the investors, will give you an understanding of how to better value your company. Every venture capital firm, the way they operate is, unless they're an evergreen fund where they don't have to make rate of returns, and it's very limited, these large corporation funds, everybody needs to make a rate of return. They need to make, and there's industry standards to that rate of return. So unless you can position your company in such a way that over the span of, you know, 12 to 18 months after that round of capital raise, you can accelerate your revenue or your traction by 10x, right? Which gives that investor the ability to go and either exit you and sell you, or, you know, bring you to other investors, increasing their pot size or their valuation of their equity in you. You're not really doing anybody justice. You're not really understanding that this is, hey, it's not just about me and my company. I have to create a symbiotic relationship with the investors I'm about to take their money from. I have to understand what their motivations are and play to those as well.
Mm-hmm. Right, right, absolutely. No, I'm pretty sure we can spend the rest of the episode talking, you know, breaking this down, because it's such a, you know, for me, it was a very, you know, dark area when it come to valuations of the startups when I was first starting out. So it was a lot of self-education. And even in the sense that it was also a discovery phase where you have to really understand not only from any particular metrics or the industry or the market size from that standpoint, but also your ability to predict kind of where some of your projections lie, where do you want to go with this, you know, with your startup. All of those factors also, you know, feed into the overall valuation of, you know, your company. So that's pretty interesting. As you collaborate and work with, you know, on both sides with the investment side and also with the entrepreneurs and the founders, talent acquisition and ability to recruit is one of the, you know, key factors for successful entrepreneurs, especially when they just starting out with limited resources. What are some of the recommendations that you provide to the startups that you work with when it comes to attracting the top talent while, you know, trying to fundraise and also having limited resources? What has worked well for you in the past, perhaps? Share with us any thoughts there.
Yeah, so I look at it as this triangle, okay? The three points in this triangle. The one is passion, one is experience, and what is needed. Those are the three things. Finding the intersection of those three as an entrepreneur, as in talent, is very important. And I'll put a heavy emphasis on passion more than the other two, right? Because the thing is, at the end of the day, a startup in the beginning, until it raises, let's say, Series A, maybe even Series B, it's all about people. And at that point, maybe now it's coming to cost cutting. Maybe there's other strategies into the future. But in the beginning, the people will dictate where the company will go. And you need to ask yourself this question for yourself and anybody you hire. Why are these people aligned to give my company an unfair advantage? Right? Why are they aligned? And it doesn't always have to be with talent. And this is what I think some people get bogged down with, is that, hey, we need to find the best people, the most talented people in the world to come to our startup. That's not necessarily the case. You sometimes have to find the best passionate people, because the most passionate people that are ready to solve the problem will work day and night, will work 80 hours, 90 hours a week. And for them, it won't be work. It will be fun because they're trying to move the mission forward. And that is what is the true essence of the difference between startup companies and talent and corporations. Whereas like that 9-to-5 barrier, I go in, I do my work. At the end of that 9-to-5, I go home. I might be a little bit passionate about the industry of the company, but usually the compensation structures within corporations are not meant to give great incentives to early employees coming, to employees coming in. Where startups, their entire mission is like, we want to build a culture. We want to build a tribe of people who really think the problem that we're solving is worth solving and will do whatever it takes. Even outside their domain, we'll wear multiple hats, we'll think about it, we'll come and we'll be able to do things. And that's what that superpower is. When you've got, you know, let's say a co-founding team, 3-4 people, or even in early employees, everybody are all passionate, thinking of different ways to solve this problem, coming together in an organized fashion, you're creating a momentum that just can't be stopped, right? And that's the beautiful part about startups. So understanding people, what you need, what expertise that is needed to, you know, right now within your organization, and also what talent that they have. You know, how can we find those three? You might find that you might hire somebody that could be a CEO, a CTO, or a CMO type role, or even a marketing manager. But after working with them for some time, you realize, wait, this is actually not your forte. You're probably really good with customers, and maybe you want to go and align that and speak with customers. That can only be done when you don't look at, you're not hiring just specifically for talent, but you're hiring for passion. Because that person will be like, yeah, you know what? I trust that you understand what I'm good at. And if you think I'm going to excel here, everything for the mission of the company, anything for the mission of the company, as long as we are doing this, I'm happy to go and do anything, as long as I'm happy and the company is moving forward.
Right. Absolutely. I think, you know, it resonates on so many levels, because I recently posted something on LinkedIn or Twitter, I can't remember, and it resonated with, so it just sparked such a great conversation. The point that I was trying to make was around, don't try to focus on hiring and interviewing only the rock stars. Instead, focus on building an environment and culture that will cultivate and produce rock stars, in a sense, which I think goes hand in hand with what you were talking about, you know, building that particular environment in a startup where you can actually bring not necessarily top performers to begin with, but someone who has great passion for a particular mission that you're trying to accomplish and succeed together. I think that's, you know, those are the ingredients for success versus
bringing. I completely agree. And, you know, I'm going to give a point here as well. I'm a Toronto native and a big Raptors fan, a Toronto Raptors NBA basketball. Yeah. And we talk about this all the time, because Toronto itself is not a very great free agent destination for NBA players. And it's also, so the thing is, other than the draft picks, which are like the top players, you have to find hidden gems and you have to develop them. So like organizations that realize, okay, maybe we don't have the resources to attract rock stars and things like that, they need to build a great development culture where you invest in people, you believe in those people, and you build them up over time, right? Once you start understanding what that really means, it's like you don't look at people as expendable. That's why this idea of hire slow, fire fast, I do understand the concept behind it, but I also don't fully agree with it. I think, you know, it's about hiring slow, which I think is important. It's about developing that talent. And if you are, before you decide, okay, this isn't worked out, you as a manager or you as a person leading these people have to realize, did I put this person in the right position to achieve what we want to? Where does my onus come into play? And if you haven't done enough to do that, you can't blame it on the employee. You cannot blame it on them saying they are the reason why, or fire them. Building that culture, you know, and that comes into having monthly checkpoints and giving them, having education, sending them to conferences so that they can learn, you know, giving them courses on Coursera and other places so they can consistently develop their tools and skill sets, allowing them to meet people and bringing mentors to teach them. That is investing in people. And that's what startups need to realize more. It's, don't worry, don't spend so much time in going and finding this HR process and headhunters and all that. Find passionate people that are willing to absorb and learn, are sponges, and then put in a great development culture that helps develop those people from where they are today into rock stars. Let's build over buying, right? Let's build over buying. It's a very big concept. And I think this is the HR or the talent side of the question, is how can we build something that we may not get on paper, might have a talented person, but when we're done with them, they will be very, very talented. They will be the most talented person in this industry because of the passion that they have and the work that we did to cultivate that passion.
Right. Absolutely. I love the quote, you know, hire slow, fire fast. That's, I might be stealing that from you. So that, you know, but that definitely resonates. It definitely makes perfect sense when it comes to really building that type of environment, especially at the startup, because you're so early stage and you're just at the formation of that particular DNA of your organization. I think those elements that you covering now are of utmost importance. So you being based in Toronto, obviously you're a citizen of the world, you travel also a lot, attend all these great events. And recently Paul Graham posted something on Twitter where basically he said something to the extent that the world is shifting in a way that Silicon Valley is not necessarily the mecca that it used to be for the founders and even the investors to flock to that area. And even now the US is not necessarily that ultimate destination because of the how globalized and virtual the world has become. Share your thoughts on that perspective. Where do you see a lot of opportunity in terms of geographical locations? Where do you see different hubs, you know, popping up with a lot of great opportunity? Curious to get your take on that.
Yeah, and again, this is the complete ethos of my company, so I'm glad you asked this question. I do agree that there is a decentralization of startup and innovation happening now. And it's funny, every country, every city right now thinks that they're the next Silicon Valley. I see articles every day. I saw Austin, an article from in Austin, Texas, saying Austin's the next big tech scene. Toronto posted something saying it's a great next scene. Berlin did that. There are pockets and hubs where innovation and talent is hot because of where the initial investment on the internet lay. There were seven nodes around the world that were started when the internet was formed. One was in California, one was in Waterloo in Canada, and there were five other ones around the world. Naturally, because of the infrastructure needed to run those data centers and things that built the internet, a lot of engineers were flocked to those regions, creating a great culture for and talent for startup organizations to exist. However, what I'm seeing now is that it's also a government and a private sector contribution towards that. You know, so like areas in the world, like in parts of Europe, especially in Berlin, right? Berlin's a massive tech hub and it's getting bigger and bigger. So is Norway, so is Poland. This is parts of Europe. We all know, obviously, the UK, London is great in this realm. I went to Reykjavik in Iceland, and they're doing something really interesting. After their last recession, the entire country decided we're going to break up our major banks. We're going to create smaller organizations, and each one of them going to have venture capital firms underneath them and investing in startups. So they did this since 2007 or 8 when that recession happened. And when I went there in 2015, I saw like a lot of that development coming into play. But right now, I am from, I was born in India. I was born in Mumbai, and I didn't live there for very long. I only lived there for 6 months when my parents moved, but I have a lot of family there. And there's an area in India called Bangalore, which is in the south part of India. When I attended a conference in 2008 called the Product Conclave by NASSCOM, they announced on that conference that last month they passed it the most number of startups of anywhere in the world, including Silicon Valley, by volume at that time in 2018. So not by capital dollars, not by spend, but by volume, Bangalore is now one of the largest epicenters for innovation. Now, other regions around the world, Dubai is spending a lot of money now in building District 2020, which is where they have an Expo 2020 happening this year. District 2020 is a startup hub. It's a city within a city meant to spur innovation and attract startups to come there. So there are these areas, and obviously we know Tel Aviv in Israel, because of military and because of how it sits in innovation, is another massive area where there's a hotbed of startups. There is a frontier coming in 2021-2022 and in the future, which I am going to be moving to and setting up an office in, and that's Africa. In 2022, now in the last 5 to 7 years, Africa has democratize itself a lot. In a lot of the dictators have been thrown out. The continent itself and all the countries are starting to mobilize and starting to organize itself better. And I've been speaking to Startups Africa and many of the other groups over there. And they've invited me to come out, to come and open an office and say, we need this. We need a global ecosystem that can allow us to connect and better do work. So as of right now, I see, Silicon Valley, The Toronto-Waterloo corridor, Tel Aviv-Israel, Berlin, Bangalore in India, obviously Shenzhen, China, which is and Shanghai, which is massive, and parts of the MENA region. All these areas are starting to pop up. But let's not focus on the areas that are popping up in opportunity, because I think it's a worldwide opportunity. And that's what I'm trying to explain with Startup Fuel more. It's not, you don't have to relocate to these regions to have access to these dollars. We're trying to bring those dollars to everywhere, no matter what small town or wherever you are. And we want people to focus less on that opportunity and more about product market fit. What you're doing and your product, does it have a fit? Is it the right place to be expanding it? Is there another region that could be better? That's the only perspective you should be thinking of from as a founder of a company. It's not about where can I get investment dollars or where can I, you know, raise capital or have an ecosystem. It's more about where is my ideal customers? Where are my ideal personas and how do I relocate so I can learn the best? Because at the end of the day, this money, this venture capital, all that stuff is a means to an end, right? It's just there to help along the way. The real value of a startup is the problem it's solving with the customers that it has. And we're starting to stray a little bit away from that with these big news acquisitions, these big news, you know, funding rounds and stuff like that. But we got to change the mentality of this entire ecosystem to come back to, we're trying to innovate. We're trying to change humanity. Every company is trying to progress us forward as a human race so we can live longer, happier, more enriched lives. And that shouldn't be left out in this conversation.
Right, right, right. No, I love the framework in the sense that focus on where your customer is versus this is the particular hub where, you know, a lot of things are happening. So I think it's a completely different framework of thought when you decide where to, you know, base your organization or where to start building your company. I think those are very interesting perspectives from that standpoint. When it comes to fundraising, especially in the last period that we've seen some crazy valuations, just insane deals happening all over the world. What are your thoughts on that perspective? Where do you see this going? Because some of the deals are obviously very unique and very niche, but also there's a great deal of startups and entrepreneurs that are being overlooked in the sense that they don't get an opportunity even because they're not necessarily parts of these associations or the clubs or the cliques or, you know, that kind of the Valley Mafia, so to say. Tell us a little bit more your thoughts on there. What are the recommendations there?
Without getting too emotional, because this is my passion right here, that the overlooked entrepreneurs, the ecosystem. I have believe venture capital is broken. I think it's very, very messed up right now and the way it's run. It's a very nepotism-based elitism culture where people who are connected in the know get the funding required and nobody else. After looking at 18,000 deals over the past 30 years, a shocking statistic came out from that. 94% of all those deals were done, the founders were white Caucasian males, 94%. And what is starting to become shocking is that VC is too subjective, right? And this subjectivity is what spurs this problem of non-equal distribution of resources. Because as one venture capital investor off the record told me, he's like, we like to invest in people that look like us. At the end of the day, we trust people that look like us and act like us, you know, at the end of the day. And because a lot of venture capital money has been come down through generational wealth or through successes in prior things, a lot of that concentration is with that ethnic group. Now, a lot of people who should have gotten capital and funding have been overlooked. And what we're trying to do with Startup Fuel and a software we built called the Pitchbox is to remove human bias outside or out of thing and use a data-driven model to allow investors to find, scout, and do due diligence on companies. A blind methodology. And, you know, I'm happy we're announcing this. I'm not sure when this podcast will be released, but over the next couple of months, we're releasing a new tool, a new feature, which is like a VC Tinder, where you can swipe left and right for startups and investors so they can find each other better. And we remove the people, their background and everything from the equation and allow the company and the growth, the traction to speak for itself first. So I 100% believe there is an unequal distribution of resources today. And this is one of the main missions my company and Startup Fuel is starting to focus on and to fight. It's to say that here's the main issue. When you this is the problem with not having diversity. When you limit who can solve problems and who can contribute, you in turn limit the types of problems you can solve. So if everybody's, all the investment is in the same group of people, there are so many other problems that other groups of people have that are not being heard, right? I'll give you an example of one. There was a female entrepreneur who was a mom. Okay, she came up with a new type of bra that allowed for breastfeeding in public without having, without showing off or without making it a public indecency. Very great idea. It was fantastic. It made a ton of sense. Very scalable. Obviously, there's tons of moms all over the world that would love to purchase this product and this company that supported female empowerment. But majority of all investors who are males just overlooked it. Said, we're not sure this is the problem. We don't know if this is that great. As soon as the first female VC firm found it, invested in it, and this company is doing phenomenal in terms of its growth. This is an example of a thing that when you don't have the right people doling out the capital who don't understand the problems because the problems are not part of their culture or their background, they don't see it. They don't make those investments. And so what I've come to realize is that not only from an altruism perspective that we should be giving equal access to everybody, but from a financial standpoint, it's actually more beneficial for investors to look beyond the traditional lens and start looking at underrepresented founders. Number one, because of new problems that they're solving that can have a much higher total addressable market than previous companies that have existed at 18,000 in the past. And number two, because of arbitrage. All of these people that are overlooked are getting lower valuations, right? They're not getting that. You're talking about these massive valuations. If you look at the numbers and you go pull up a lot of these companies with massive valuations, I bet you anything, a number above 65 to 80% of that number would be the same white Caucasian males that are getting the same increased valuations. Whereas the same counterpart, probably even further along in the business, who are underrepresented, aren't getting the same valuations or even the same attention. So any investor who would back those people can see a lot larger upside, which is what arbitrage is, right? To see undercover opportunities around the space. So we need this for our human society. We need this, and venture capital needs this to improve its rate of returns. It needs it to improve its viewpoint on how we do business, right? And whether or not they're accepting this, because why would people in privilege, in a power, want to change? Why would they want to? Why would you want to get away from something that has made you successful for a very long time? It's going to be the power of the people. And the people are going to start, and it's already started. You can see the social movements happening all over the US. Google's this month is now on launching a Black women in founder program, accelerator program. Yep. People are starting to take notice that underrepresented groups can have a lot more power and have a lot more upside. And the culture is starting to change. And we just want to add more fuel, no pun intended, to that fire.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a very interesting area. And I'm fully on board with everything you're talking about, because being an immigrant and minority myself, I've experienced that, especially first coming to the US and just getting exposed to that particular environment. I think that's very interesting. A lot of opportunity for improvement. But at the same time, there's quite a few really cool organizations and companies that making pretty good dent in that particular case, such as Eric from Hustle Fund, or Janine at Overlooked Ventures, or Nitin, who built Unshackled Ventures. They all focus on immigrant founders, yes. Overlooked founders. I think that's a very unique space. And I personally very interested in funding and investing into immigrant founders myself, mainly because I'm able to relate and connect on many levels from a perspective of being scrappy and at the same time, propensity to succeed with very limited resources. Because for me, that's one of the key ingredients of successful founder is being able to just make something happen out of nothing. When nothing is given, nothing is granted, everything is earned. So I think that's a very interesting perspective.
I love that, man. I love, can you repeat that, what you just said, that last line? I love it.
Yeah, it's basically nothing is given, everything is earned.
Everything is earned. I echo that. And nothing should be given. Everything should be earned. I love that.
Yep. And, unfortunately, I see a lot of, from my deal flow, the startup founders that I see, they almost kind of acting in the sense that it's, you know, taking this for granted that, you know, the venture capital angel investing is something that's supposed to be kind of almost the given component versus, you know, let me first show some traction. Let me first show you what I'm capable of achieving something with absolutely nothing. And then let's try to collaborate. So I think this is just interesting dynamics that are.
Yeah. And the good thing is that the company that we're acquiring right now is fully embodying exactly that, connecting underrepresented founders to underrepresented companies. Hopefully by the end of this week, we'll have them under Startup Fuel now, and we'll be able to push. They have a lot of connections into government, into corporations, and to try to, mm-hmm. you know, push underrepresented founders and connect them with investors. And this is going to be a big part of our ethos. And even about a year and a half ago, I noticed this traveling around the world. I met entrepreneurs in the same city, you know, where people were overlooked because of their race, ethnic background, sexual orientation, gender. And I said, okay, why don't we start adding some tags to the site which highlights these people? And we did. And people started adding and started indicating that they're a female-founded company or have these things. And now that we've hit more than 2,000 companies registered in 556 cities around the world, nice. We have a large concentration of underrepresented founders who've self-identified themselves. And now we can connect them with our software. So the pitch box, the software we built, is specifically meant for these type of venture capital firms. They're called impact firms who look at people, planet, and profit, triple bottom line. So how are we investing for diversity? How are we investing to create jobs and help the humanity? How are we helping the planet? What are we doing? Clean tech, carbon neutralization, things like that. And then profit, then rate of return. This right. is how I built the software. And all these companies are my people that I'm targeting to either do demos with, to show Unshackled Ventures, Overlooked Ventures. I can give you a whole list of them. They're all part of my, either people I've demoed to or I've spoken to. And I'm getting almost 60 to 80% conversion from a demo to trial for people to try it out just because of the fact that they get it. Everyone understands that this is a big issue in the space. We need to equally distribute the resources, right? That are available. And today it's not happening. So good on you. For angel investing into that type of immigrant founders, overlooked people that you know that normally wouldn't get it. These are the people that do something great with little to nothing, mm-hmm. right? 100%. That's what entrepreneurship is about. It's not, hey, I wrote an idea on the back of a napkin, and because I know somebody, or because I had a previous business, I went to an investor and they gave me $10 million to build this up. No. Like that's great. Now that $10 million, you split that up into like five companies and you invested into five, you know, underrepresented founders, more than three to four of them are showing that they will outpace that $10 million company no matter what. And I have data to back it up if anybody wants to question that. So I'm trying our best to not only show this from a human perspective, but from a financial perspective. And I think that's what investors really are, you know, have been missing out on.
100%. I love that framework. You know, diversifying and making the smaller bets, I think it's one of the, you know, opportunities in this space. Ash, last but not least, the last portion of each episode, I'd like to focus on the sources that you utilize, consume on daily basis for your own self-education, self-actualization with so much information thrown at us on daily basis. How selective are you where you let your mind be exposed to? What's your content diet?
Yeah, I honestly, I'm very different from most people. I'm not a big fan of reading or podcasts, or like, you know, that spend like a lot of time. I do like listening here and there. I'm a people person. I'm an extreme extrovert. I love talking to people and learning from others. And the beautiful part about, you know, what I learned starting to network when I initially started to network because I thought it would be a great way to build up my network, right? And my net worth by the people I had. But as I started to do more, I noticed that everybody I was talking to at these startup events and stuff were experts in their field or are very passionate about the field, and they're finding new ways to disrupt it. And just by talking with them, I'm getting a lot of experience and knowledge and understanding that aren't in books, that aren't in podcasts. And a lot of times, especially in the startup world, I feel like sometimes a lot of this information is backward looking. You know, when you read something, it took the writer some time to write that and took it some time to publish it and to get it to in your hands. And the startup world moves so fast and pivots and change that some of the details in those things are not relevant for today. Yep. Right. And they're not but the most relevant source are people at these events and people that are researching it on a daily basis that condense all the noise into actionable items that are good for them and then come and talk to you about them. And I've learned so much about that. One good book though I will recommend, and I want to explain this is I was invited to come to Milwaukee by Generator, which is a massive accelerator in the US. And they had the keynote speaker at the event was Brad Smith, who is the president of Microsoft. Okay. And he wrote this book and he was giving it out and doing book signing with this book. It's called Tools and Weapons. And I recommend every entrepreneur read this. This is talking about technology. The future of technology can either be a tool or it can be a weapon, right? And we as fast tech ecosystem leaders have to understand that we have the power to change lives, tons and tons of lives. And because of that, we have a duty of governance, of understanding that we need to put in place governance structures that sometimes supersede our local governments. Obviously, you know, you can see Twitter and Facebook and all these companies are worldwide. So one government's rules might conflict with another's rules on what is acceptable or what morality is. So understanding that there is going to be difference of opinions and clash in the way things are done, but planning for that and understanding that your role as a tech leader can change how the future of the world will work and how it operates is really important. Like TikTok, for example. Yep. TikTok is an example of something that blew up and is doing well, but it promotes quite a bit of, you know, in some ways, over-sexualization of young people sometimes. And this is something that I wish that TikTok's founder in early on came and decided to build something into it that allowed to realize that this is going to be the problem into the future. Now it's very tough for them to change. I was hearing an article about this, that they're trying to, you know, put more governance in the way that social media content is being put out. Had the founders of the companies at the early stage put these things in place from day one and understood that what they're doing has the power to change millions and millions of lives, a lot of things, a lot of problems, a lot of data breaches, a lot of things could have been avoided if that was the fact. And that's why I think when it comes to content, I would say that number one source is people. Number two source is random articles, medium.com. I like reading stuff here and there that pop up into my newsfeed, newsletters from companies that I follow. I like those are the main sources. And then here and there, books that are really highly recommended. I meet at events or I meet the authors and I believe in the authors. I like listen to them, what they're saying. And I say, okay, you're authentic. That is something that I would like I would like people, anybody listening, take away from this is that any founder who's building a global company, you have a duty and a responsibility to your customers, the users, and society around you. Mm-hmm. Think about that long term and plan to do your part to make the world better, not worse.
Right. I love these recommendations. And for our listeners, we'll make those titles and other things that Ash had mentioned in an episode notes. Ash, can't thank you enough for your time today. A very short and insightful conversation. Personally, learned quite a bit. We're going to stay in touch. What I love doing with all of my guests is a follow-up episode in about a year to see how much of change transpired, revisit the conversation from a year ago, listen to that and see what everything we've predicted and talked about still makes sense. So I'm definitely looking forward to that.
Yeah, I'd love to come on. I mean, it's a fantastic idea, actually, seeing the before and the after. A lot of context. Yeah, because look, startups and everything, it's not about points. And I think this is something that investors talk about. It's not dots, it's lines. Yeah. Right? You don't look at dots. You're not looking at one instance. You're looking at how lines are growing. So this is an example of that. You're looking at, hey, 1 year from now, when we talk again, how has the line changed? Which direction has it gone? We can learn so much insight from that delta, right? So kudos on you. And I'd love to be part of the recap episode in the year.
For sure. Well, we're definitely not going to talk once a year. It's definitely going to be, you know, more frequent conversation, but it's definitely going to be exciting conversation again. So thanks so much.
Nah, no worries. And thank you for having me on the show. It's been amazing. And, you know, a lot of the points and the questions that you asked, I think are very relevant to today's world. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to come in and sing my song.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.